across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Tuition fees, they've gone up in England. They're about around 10k in England. Here in Northern Ireland, under 5k. Is that a good thing? Or actually, would that money be better spent elsewhere and these students are getting an education? Should we, the taxpayer, be subsidising them? They're going to go on to be taxpayers. And we're going to hear from a student today that telling us that if the fees went up, it would block her out of education. So it's a really interesting debate, actually. And then a profoundly worrying story that came up after 10 in the programme today. About respite care and how a father's telling us that his son couldn't walk properly after coming out of it. To have a listen. The Stephen Nolan Show. Good morning. I'm excited about tonight. I've got the prawn cocktail crisps out. Actually, I've got a box of them and my special event pajamas to sit up and watch the US election coverage tonight. We know, according to some of the polls, but we don't really know, do we? Because the polls have been wrong in the past, but they're predicting this could be the closest presidential election in living memory. The candidates spent the last day of campaigning in the crucial swing states, which will decide who wins the White House. Buckler is in America for us. We'll speak to him in a second or two. Before that, here's a reminder of how the campaign has played out over the last few months.
You know, in recent weeks, it's become clear to me I need to unite my party, so I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
Throughout this campaign, I've seen the best of America, and I've seen what is holding you back and weighing you down. High costs, fundamental rights taken away, and politics that have driven fear and division.
When I first came into office, I cut taxes more than any other president. We developed the greatest economy in history by far. When I left office, it changed. Inflation destroyed the lives of so many people. Our country has gone to hell.
They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
You talk about extreme. As president, I'll bring a new generation of leadership. I'll take on price gouging and bring down the cost of groceries and housing and prescriptions. I'll fight for your freedom to make your own choices, and I will protect your health care and your benefits, not take them away.
We're going to make America great again, greater than ever before.
I will fight for you with every breath, and I will never let you down.
We have momentum. It is on our side. Can you feel it?
President Trump is literally putting his life on the line.
All we have to do is go out on Tuesday and vote, vote, vote.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
Right, let's head over to the States. Buckler, where are you this morning?
Yeah, I am in Philadelphia. Of course, this is one of the big places where they want to go. They want to try and ensure that they do get votes because Pennsylvania is this key swing state.
Trump was saying last night, you win Pennsylvania, he's won the whole thing. Now, that's not true, but that's what he was selling last night.
Some polls just think it might be true. If you take a look at it, it is very much the case that they believe that the electoral votes here, of course, you need 270 electoral votes, and 19 here are very much dependent on who can win them as to who the election could potentially go to. If you take a look back in 2016, we've said this before, Joe Biden was not in that race. He won it in 2020, but Donald Trump won it in 2016. So that's how it kind of swings from Democrat to Republican and why it is so important. I was going to mention, though, that the reason that we are in Philadelphia is because last night, only a matter of a few hours ago, Kamala Harris wrapped up her campaign here in the center of Philadelphia, a place that you will probably know very well because you've watched the Rocky movies. The place where Rocky runs up and down the
steps
to the Museum of Art. Well, they, you saw Kamala Harris run up those steps as well to stand in front of a sign that said that she would be a president for all, trying to win people over, but also with an incredibly young and motivated crowd.
So how is America, Buckler, going to be different under President Harris or under President Trump? What's going to be different about it?
Do you know, it's a question I've been asking, and simply, you know, you can't be entirely sure. First of all, if you think about the White House, although a president is sitting there, does have a huge number of powers, actually there are all sorts of constraints on them, which is part of the thing that Donald Trump found so frustrating the last time when he was president. He felt he should be able to do what he wants, but actually there are the checks and balances that they talk so much about in America. But it certainly is going to give a direction for where politics is going in the United States, and they are very, very different candidates. If you look at the issue of women's rights, for example, if you look at the issue of abortion, Kamala Harris is obviously more liberal than Donald Trump. That is something that is motivating a lot of people to vote. In some cases, of course, it's women who feel very strongly that they should have the right to choose about what happens with their bodies. On the other hand, actually, Donald Trump has quite an evangelical following from some people who feel that he is saying what they want to hear, that they will look at abortion laws, they will potentially allow states to restrict abortion laws. That has become a huge issue in this campaign. The other one is the economy. What do you do going forward? Well, Kamala Harris is getting accused of saying she'll be doing more of the same, but she wants to try to improve the economy, of course. As for Donald Trump, though, there is this potential issue of tariffs. And we saw tariffs being this massive issue when it came to relationships between countries the last time he was in the White House. And he seems to think tariffs are a very good way of trying to deal with some of these issues.
Is he more likely to do some type of deal, stroke reach an agreement with Putin, than Harris is?
What does a deal with Putin mean? Does that mean a deal as regards Ukraine? Or what does it mean?
That's
in
what
terms
I mean.
Of a deal with
That's
Putin?
What I mean, the war in Ukraine.
Well, I think it would be very difficult for Donald Trump to do a deal. But what does a deal mean? Really, it comes down to this question and this issue of funding for Ukraine. And it's simple as that. What is potentially more likely, and certainly if you talk to some of Donald Trump's supporters, they want him to look at that idea of funding, to restrict the amount of money that America is spending overseas. A deal with Putin? What kind of deal can Donald Trump make there? And ultimately, whenever you get an idea of Russia and Ukraine being involved in a war, does America really want to get involved in that? Does Donald Trump really want to get involved with that? You might argue that, you know, he was somebody who wanted to talk to Vladimir Putin. He certainly made lots of claims about the idea that Putin would not have invaded if he had been in the White House. But you've also got to remember, Donald Trump is the man who talks about putting America first. He's the one that's interested in what is inside the borders of this country and also about trying to secure those borders.
You've been speaking to some fans. Super fans.
Yeah. You're going to like this woman very much, Stephen.
How do you
this
know?
This is Patty Bowman. Well, because she is an entertaining figure. I went to Belfast, Pennsylvania. I thought I would travel from one Belfast to another. And it is a place with a little bit of divisive politics going on there as well. Patty turned up to see me wearing everything Trump. Wait till you hear about some of her Trump collection. Patty, just you describe to me what you're wearing here.
My Trump apparel.
Like, it's a lot of Trump apparel.
Yeah.
So we've got a MAGA hat.
Yeah.
We've got a Stars and Stripes hoodie. We've got a t-shirt that says, "This is my president." And it is a picture of Donald Trump just after he's been shot.
I love it. I love everything about him. I got so many shirts. I got so many hats. I even have the hat with the hair.
This is the Donald Trump hair.
Yeah, with the Donald Trump hair. You ever see that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have that hat. And I have a Trumpinator bear.
What is that?
It's a Trumpinator bear. It's a teddy bear. But it's like, has a, like a I'll be back coat, like the Terminator. And it's wearing sunglasses. And then I have a whole bunch of other stuff. I have a doll that talks. He says different sayings.
Do you not worry about some of the things Donald Trump says? Do you not worry about how divisive and difficult this election has become? And even the kind of mudslinging that takes place between candidates.
Well, Joe Biden just called us garbage. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
And everybody's like, oh, I'm going to wear my garbage bag to vote. It's for garbage. And then I was watching the rally in MSG in New York. I watch all his rallies on TV on the RSBN network.
And you've been to rallies as well, haven't you?
I've been to two rallies.
And what are they like? Give us an idea of why you go and what kind of atmosphere it's like.
It's energizing. And I waited 5 hours in line for him in Schnecksville, PA. The support, it's like a big love fest. Everybody's so happy. Everybody's dancing. They play music. It's just energizing. It's electric.
What do you think of Donald Trump's dancing?
Well, I'm going to do that happy dance too. It's like everybody loves it. Everybody loves when he starts dancing at the end to the YMCA. I even have my notification sent on my phone to the YMCA. You know, with all the stuff that people say about him, they try to take him down. You know, they try to shoot him, they try to indict him, they try to arrest him. They took his picture, his mugshot. You know, it's just like, you know, it's unbelievable. And it's like he's a family man, he's a grandfather, you know.
There are people that do question the morals of Donald Trump, though. The Stormy Daniels, adult film star.
Yeah, I don't, you know, everybody's like, well, look at all that stuff he did, you know, and I was like, well, he's still my president, you know, I don't care what they say about him.
Buckley, the sense I'm getting from this, listening to that lady speaking to you and watching more and more of this from afar, is that Donald Trump, the showman, is so attractive to so many of his voters. It's about how he dances. It's about the quips he makes, the jokes he makes, for goodness sake. And they're talking about that ahead of talking about his policies.
Well, this is a personality election. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And it always will be when Donald Trump is involved. If you look at this whole issue of Donald Trump and who his supporters are, it comes down to the idea that they believe in Donald Trump. It's not necessarily about policy. You know, I talked to somebody else who said, I don't care about his personal life. I don't care about the allegations they make about him. I don't care about the court cases. I believe in Donald Trump. And I mean, you listened to Patty there. I mean, she was saying she loves Donald Trump. Donald Trump is her president no matter what happens, and she will support him no matter what. And that is partly because in America, personality is so big. What I would say, though, is there's also a lot of people that go very, very strongly against Donald Trump's personality. It is why this is such a divided election, because there are people who love Donald Trump and there are people who, to use the word probably correctly, hate Donald Trump.
What about Pastor Kirkland? Who's this?
Yeah, so I went to another part of Philadelphia. It's on the outskirts. It's a little suburb called Chester. Now, it's a mainly black population there. And it's an area which does have a number of problems, particularly poverty. It's not particularly well off. And I got speaking to Pastor Thaddeus Kirkland. It's a great name in itself. He's actually the former mayor of Chester. And I spoke to him as a number of people were gathering for a gospel show that they were putting on. And he told me that this election is very, very important. But you get another side of it, because what you do hear from some of those who support Kamala Harris is this belief that big things need to be addressed in America. There's real concern about the economy. Some people believe Donald Trump is the best person to solve that. But there are others who think that the little person may miss out. And one of those is Thaddeus.
I think this election is very important. It's probably the most important election we've had in quite some time. It's about democracy versus a tyrant. I mean, it's just that simple.
That's how you feel it? Yeah. Trump is a tyrant as far as you're concerned?
Well, I mean, watch this. You have somebody that says that I want to be in complete control of everything. You have someone that has 34 felonies under his belt. You have someone who doesn't have the greatest respect for females.
When you look around Chester as well, I mean, we're in the middle of Chester. This is a place that could do with investment. It could do with some money spent on it. there will be some people arguing the economy's not been doing as well as it perhaps could do. People are spending so much more for their groceries. Does it not need a change, maybe?
They forgot that we had that we just went through COVID. We went through 2 years of dealing with COVID, dealing with a lot of deaths, dealing with a lot of rising costs, dealing with a lot of rising medical costs. And so we're just now coming out of that COVID experience, which was a very negative experience for all of us. And here in the United States, just the same way throughout the world, we have our ups and we have our downs. You're going to have a time when it's plentiful in the land, and you have a time when it's very little in the land. It's just the way of the world. The world is like a roller coaster.
Could be quite a roller coaster after Tuesday, though.
Yeah, it could be. That's why I'm keeping my fingers crossed, my eyes crossed, my legs crossed. I'm hoping that we would look at that the people would look at Kamala Harris as a kind of unifying force. And it's hard. It's going to be hard to bring this community back together, or this country back together. But we have to for the future.
Right, Buckler. I was out last night getting the crisps and the chocolate for tonight. So I'm going to sit up all night. I'll be tired on the radio in the morning with all that eating I'm going to do watching this. Talk us through the timeline of this and when we'll know.
Yeah. I don't know if you're going to know is the simple answer. And I spoke to a reporter this morning on Good Morning Ulster who told me that she doesn't believe that Pennsylvania is likely to be called until Friday.
Oh, for goodness sake. I can't wait till then.
Yeah, well, that's the point. And actually, the candidates are going to find it a tough couple of days. And people forget, but this happened in 2020 as well, that there was a bit of indecision for a couple of days. If this is particularly tight, then it's going to be maybe even longer than that. One of the big difficulties is that
Why?
They gather all of the ballots. Well, if you talk about Pennsylvania, they've different ways of doing things in different places. But Pennsylvania, for example, you see all of those early ballots they've gathered.
Yeah.
They've gone and they've taken them. So they've had people who've been putting them into drop boxes. There have been people who have been voting. Some people have a chance to kind of do their vote in different ways. They are all gathered and stored. And they will not be opened until the polls have been closed. And as a result, there is a huge amount to go through.
So when I've seen in other presidential elections, Christopher, the CNN predicts, Fox News predicts, whoever it is.
Oh, you'll get that.
Are we going to get that tonight?
Oh, yeah, you'll have that. You'll
have predictions on a constant basis.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You will certainly get, and they will be calling states. So it won't just be a case of who has won the White House, because that takes a lot of time. But what they will do is they will call individual states. You will have the big American showpieces in which they do those countdowns. You would love to do that, Nolan. There's absolutely no doubt about that. You know, this idea of having musical countdowns to a declaration. So you'll have CNN, you'll have the likes of NBC, ABC, all saying that they are making a prediction and a declaration that they believe that individuals have won different states, and then they have to do the maths.
I think we need an inquiry as to why BBC Northern Ireland sent you out there and not me.
I think you've been very welcome, and you spend enough time in America. I mean, you know, you could
yes,
certainly have just turned up and had a talk to people. Although, of course, in California, it's not really a contest.
Thank you, Buckler. Speak to you soon. That's Buckler setting it up for us this morning. Speaking in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh last night, Trump blamed Harris for America's problems.
Kamala Harris has delivered soaring prices and economic anguish at home, war and chaos abroad, and nation-destroying invasion on our southern border like nobody's ever seen before. She's actually a disaster. My message to Americans tonight is simple. We do not have to live this way. We don't.
Across the state in Philadelphia, Harris said her supporters were positive about America's future.
We are optimistic and we are excited about what we can do together. And we know it is time for a new generation of leadership in America. And I am ready to offer that leadership as the next president of the United States of America.
Dr. Julie Norman, co-director of the Centre in US Politics at University College London, with us this morning. Morning, Julie.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm reading a tweet here and that's been sent to me. The BBC can't have it, says this tweeter, that Americans are actually attracted to Trump's views. I don't know what this punter's talking about, because we're interrogating both sides. We're talking to fans and supporters of both sides. But what is it about each of these candidates, Julie, that is attractive to their base?
Sure. So I think you heard it from Trump supporters and some of the quotes that your reporters were hearing. You know, people get very excited by Trump as a person. He has a certain charisma that speaks to a lot of people. And I think for a lot of Americans who feel left out of, say, the seemingly elite institutions, the media, the businesses, they feel like Trump really speaks to them and understands them and kind of highlights their voices and grievances in a different kind of way. So for his base, there is that. And there are others who don't really find Trump himself appealing, but think that he's better on the economy, think that he's better on immigration, and just align with him more on issues. For Democrats, I would say it's a lot of anti-Trump vote. Obviously, Trump himself is very polarizing. There's many Democrats who are voting on the issue of abortion, many on the issue of democracy. And I would say some who just really found Kamala's kind of approach and appeal to bringing joy back, to bringing hope back, very appealing and a bit of a different messaging than Trump.
How much misinformation has there been during the electioneering this week?
Yeah, I would say there's been a lot throughout the campaign. Some of that has been, from candidates themselves and some of the things that they've said in their speeches and ads. But moreover, just from, the social media landscape that we have, and we're aware of, external groups trying to make a mark. And so people are seeing many different things, especially on their social media feeds, some of which are more accurate than others.
Can you believe how tight it is?
I mean, I think we all expected there would be some kind of, shift in these last couple of weeks or days, but instead it's just really stuck on this 50-50 razor's edge kind of place. And I would point out that, polls indicate that it's going to be close. We expect that it will. With that said, earlier elections, the 2012 election with Obama, was polling very close, and then he, was a very clear winner. 2016 with Hillary Clinton and Trump seemed like it was going to be a runaway for her, and then obviously was very close and Trump won. So the polls can indicate a lot, but they're just models and things can go very differently on election day.
What's your gut telling you? Who's going to win?
Oh, gosh. I have avoided taking any kind of stances so far. I mean, I'm going to stick with my cop out, I think. I really do feel it could go either way, and it could be a runaway or it could be close. So I'm just going to stick with that.
Okay, Dr. Julie Norman, thank you. First call of the day, Joseph in Derry. Morning, Joseph.
Hi, good morning to you, Stephen. Stephen, thanks, bye. This is all very big hype in America. But let's look at this scenario. We currently in Northern Ireland have First Minister and Deputy First Minister who are both female. I'm just wondering, how would they react to a Trump win and a request for a visit to Northern Ireland?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, he is a convicted felon, and one of those particular convictions relate to a sex offence.
Well, presumably how our First and Deputy First Minister would react would be similar to how most countries would react, which is to welcome the office holder of that position.
But is this the first time in history that an office holder of that post has been convicted?
Are you seriously suggesting little old Northern Ireland could somehow shun the President of the United States, Joseph?
If I would just explore this particular point, and that is the only people that Donald Trump has been sucking up to at the moment have been dictators. So he's not really worried about anybody else, given the fact that when he was giving his speeches, he couldn't talk about policies. The only person who was talking about real policies that affected the people were Kamala Harris. So what I mean, that is a fact. That is a fact, Stephen. You know,
who do you want to win?
Eh? Of course, I want Kamala to win. Because she's the person who's going to take it forward and unite the country.
Who do you think's going to win?
I think Kamala will win.
Are you sitting up tonight?
Not tonight, no. Because if you look at the time difference, it would be a waste of time.
Do you know what I want you all doing? I want you all on my Twitter feed tonight. Talk to me about what you're, how you're thinking about all of this. That's Stephen Nolan. You can hear it right throughout the night on BBC Radio 5 Live as well. It'll be on BBC Television. But for those of you in Northern Ireland that like me, are sitting up, I'll be up tonight. So you can keep me company on Twitter tonight at Stephen Nolan. Joseph, thank you. Let's pause there. Sure. And we'll get the news at 9:30. Right, good morning to you. So we're having a look at student fees today. Why are we doing this here in Northern Ireland? Well, the government has decided to put student fees up. They'll go up to around 10 grand a year in England. But here in Northern Ireland, the taxpayer continues to subsidise them and subsidise student fees here in Northern Ireland to the tune that, compared to in England, where it's around 10 grand a year, our student fees are half that, just under 5 grand a year. So obviously the discussion that I want to have this morning with you is, do you think that's money well spent? How could you spend money better, you could argue, than educating the next generation of workers and people in this country? Other people might think, do you know what? Let them get their debt. Let them pay back their debt when they get jobs, and there's better use of that money. 030 30 80 55 55. John Campbell, our business economics editor, he's been working hard this month, hasn't he? Good morning, John.
Hello there, Stephen. Hi.
As opposed to the easy time you get every other month, John, is the inference in this, of course.
Terrible inference.
So, tuition fees, very much, there always has been a difference between Northern Ireland and England. There's a difference in Scotland as well, because they get it for nothing in Scotland.
Yes.
But what's happened in England? Spell this out to us.
So the current maximum tuition fee for full-time undergrads in Northern Ireland is just under £5,000. It's a bit under £5,000. In GB, it's £9,250. And basically what the UK Education Secretary announced yesterday is that she was intending to put that up a bit for people in England. So they will be paying higher fees once again, and almost basically double, I suppose, what we are paying in Northern Ireland in terms of undergraduate tuition fees. And this has been looked at a number of times by Stormont, and it was certainly looked at when Stormont was down. If you remember, there was all those loads of consultations which the Secretary of State did on revenue raising, there was basically a piece of work done which said that if tuition fees in Northern Ireland were raised to the same level as those in GB, it would bring in about an additional £98 million a year. But Conor Murphy, who is the minister responsible for higher education in Northern Ireland, he basically, when he came into power, more or less ruled out raising fees immediately. He said he didn't think fees were the way to go. He thought they were likely to reduce uptake in places and universities.
So, John, is that coming out of our block grant? Are we subsidising the tuition fees to that level?
I suppose you could put it that way, yeah. It's like, I suppose that's the point of devolution. You know, different devolved administrations have different priorities. And as you say, in Scotland, for Scottish students studying in Scotland, that they don't have fees at all. And I suppose, you know, some of the argument around tuition fees in Northern Ireland is not so much about the amount of money it would raise, but the amount of places which you could have in universities, because we know, for example, in Derry, the very long-term push to get a bigger university in Derry, and effectively the argument is that with the current fee structure, it's very hard to expand the number of places because there's just not enough money in the system. So if you increased the fees rather than creating, you know, £100 million a year to spend in other areas in the public services, you would just use that money to increase the number of student places, that would help accelerate the growth of the university in Derry. It would mean that more young people could stay to study in Northern Ireland rather than having to go away.
And look, John, I don't expect you to have these stats in your head, but there will be a statistic, I'm sure we can dig it out, of how much on average more someone that goes through university earns during their lifetime than someone who doesn't. And that should help us at least inform part of the debate as to whether students, if their earning capacity goes up because of their education, should be paying some of that themselves back or not in a student loan, in other words.
It depends on the degree, basically. So I know, just off the top of my head, that people who do an economics degree tend to have a very big kind of positive uplift in their earnings compared to people who would either do no degree or do some other sort of degree. So, and obviously there's other ones like medicine as well, where, you know, there's clearly that unlocks additional earnings for you. So it does depend on the degree. And, you know, so students will argue, you know, anybody who's graduated in Northern Ireland will argue at the minute, well, yes, I am paying it back. So that already exists. It's just the level that you set it at.
And how does this work? As usual, I don't understand the basics of this here. So look, if in England tuition fees are around 10 grand, as you've spelled out, here in Northern Ireland, yeah, half that, are just under 5 grand. Are Queen's running at a loss in educating the students, who's paying the money?
The issue is the number of places. So that is where that manifests itself in the system, is it reduces the number of places which the universities are able to offer to UK-based students. Now, there's foreign students is a different matter because they pay full fees.
They pay a fortune, right?
Yeah, exactly. So overseas students have been a kind of big revenue-raising measure for universities across the whole of the UK, although a little less so in the last year or so. But that is basically, so if you're asking, how does the difference between the two systems in GB and Northern Ireland manifest? And the answer, I think, is it means that there are fewer places available for domestic students in Northern Ireland than there otherwise would be if the fees were higher.
I'm not asking that. Here's what I am asking. I'm interested in this 100 million of cost or potential revenue. I don't understand how that goes into the executive if it's about the contract between the student and the university. So where's the 100, because, the 98 because million coming
the,
from?
Because basically some of the money going to the universities is coming from Stormont. And there's a system called the Mazin cap system. I needn't go into the the way that all works. That's basically, there's like a,
you can do
a,
that and a, even an extra
of, there's a formula which they use to work out how many places they can afford effectively.
Okay, John, thank you very much. That's really helpful this morning. Of course, there are other funding issues, aren't there, that we should be talking about. We know that Conor Murphy's party colleague, the finance minister, Keith Archibald, has warned Stormont departments will still have to take difficult decisions to balance the books this year. This is wider, obviously, than education. She told MLAs yesterday the executive is not currently in line to get one-off funding from the government to cover the costs of the PSNI data breach, for example. Let's have a listen.
As a result of the interim fiscal framework, which I agreed in May this year, the executive has received £184 million more than it would have otherwise done in 24-25. I will now move quickly to propose allocations to the executive to get this funding out to departments as part of the October monitoring round. As you are aware, departments previously identified resource del pressures of £770 million, so the extra funding falls short of what is needed and is not sufficient to meet the trajectory of overspend that departments have indicated for this year. This will inevitably mean departments having to take decisions to live within budget. The overcommitment figure does not include the costs of a number of exceptional items, such as the cost of the PSNI data breach, Haldy pay and McLeod injury to feelings. It was anticipated that if these costs were to crystallise in 24-25, that they might be funded by a reserve claim. However, given the level of in-year funding provided to the Executive in this autumn budget, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury has indicated that while further conversations are possible, the Treasury position is that in the first instance these should be funded from the settlements announced. It is my clear view, however, that these items would be unaffordable given the existing pressures facing departments, and therefore I would be seeking to negotiate for a reserve claim.
Right, so let's get our heads around what all of that means. We were talking, John, about Northern Ireland getting more money than we expected. Kiva now saying, but hold on a moment, this PSNI data breach, that's going to cost money, and it's coming out of that money that's come here. How much is that likely to cost? Ah, John's... We'll see if we can get John Campbell back. I think I said thank you to him for talking about education, and he's thought he can go off and get his breakfast now this morning. So we'll see if we can get him back. I think it's going to cost about 200 odd million, about 220 million quid to pay for the PSNI data breach alone. Then our Finance Minister, Keith Archibald, they're talking about other costs as well. Injury to feelings was one of them. The overtime bill that there is as well. So, John, you're back with us. Good morning. You did a runner this morning. So, with this, I was saying that this money that we got into Northern Ireland, that we thought, okay, we've got more than we expected. The Finance Minister pointing out, but hold on a moment, we've PSNI bills to pay.
Yeah. So, basically, in the budget, we got 660 million extra for public services this year, most of that for day-to-day spending and a bit for investment. And then next year, there's a further £1.5 billion. And Keith Archibald was giving an update to the executive yesterday about finances. And she turned to the costs of the PSNI data breach, which is certainly going to be over 100 million, and a couple of other court cases relating to both holiday pay and pensions, which will be additional tens of millions. And she was telling MLAs that the executive had been hoping to make what's called a reserve claim. So that's when this is, reserve is basically a special treasury fund, which exists to cover things which are unforeseen, unavoidable and unaffordable. So basically you need to meet all three of those criteria to get money out of this. It's unforeseen, it's unavoidable and it's unaffordable. So the executive were hoping to go to the treasury and saying, hello, can we have some money out of the reserve fund to pay for this data breach because we think it meets that criteria. But the minister said the Treasury's position is no, it doesn't. That's your own problem. You'll have to sort it out from the money you've already been given. So Keith Archibald said, we don't really accept this, and we still consider this PSNI data breach bill to be unaffordable. So we are still trying to get money out of the reserve for that. But at the moment, the liability for the PSNI data breach, the financial liability, is lying with the executive and its existing budget and not with the UK government, which is what the executive would like.
So, John, what's the total cost of all of this police stuff?
There's a range, I think that the range of estimates for the data breach ranges from, I think, about 140 million. I think the Chief Constable said recently. And there's been a higher estimate of up to 240 million. I think the holiday pay thing for the PSNI alone is 40 million. I don't know if that affects other public bodies as well. And then there's this thing called the McLeod judgment on pensions, which again, we didn't go into that now. And I don't know off the top of my head how much that's going to cost.
Okay.
But you put all these things together and you're certainly talking a figure probably north of 200 million at least to set all these things.
John, we'll let you go now. Thank you very much. Thanks for all of that this morning. The Police Federation have been in touch with us. They say no one-off government funding to cover the cost of the data breach is disappointing and regrettable. They say if payments have to be made from Stormont's finances for both the breach and the police holiday pay claim, they will place an intolerable pressure on public finances. The insistence by the Treasury, say the Police Fed, that the bill will have to be borne by the devolved administration is grossly unfair. That coming into us from the Police Federation this morning. Student fees and whether they should go up in Northern Ireland, they've certainly gone up in England, is what we're talking about today. Ellie Jo Taylor. Good morning, Ellie Jo.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning. why should we? You're studying law and politics. Why should we pay for your education? Why not run it? Why not borrow the money and pay it back when you're making the big bucks?
Why should you pay for it? So I think in general, we have a huge like brain drain here. We actually need to encourage people to stay in Northern Ireland. And I'm one of the students who really want to do. So I think the fact that we have lower tuition payments has encouraged me to stay, particularly because I'm one of the students in Queen's who came in through the Widening Participation Programme. So I was targeted specifically because I came from a background that wasn't supposed to go to university in terms of society. So for me, if tuition fees were about 9k, that would have priced me out completely of staying in Northern Ireland, probably of university in general. So that's why I could never have went to England. So it does cause me stress now, but the idea that other students might be impacted by this in the future.
But it wouldn't have priced you out, Ellie Jo. It would have laden you with debt, and you only pay that student debt back when you're earning enough money to be able to do so. Was that still too scary for you?
No, in general, I think debt is scary, particularly coming from a low-income background. I think we also have to look at the Northern Irish system as a beast within itself, different than the UK system. So for us, we have a lower fee to repay that whenever we do go into the working world. Ours is lower. And also beyond that, England in general is investing way more in their students, so their loans and maintenance grants are generally higher. Ours hasn't increased with inflation in over 10 years. So for us, Northern Irish students are already getting the worst deal. Our tuition payments may be lower, but in terms of what we're actually surviving on currently, we actually invest much less.
I'm interested in your background. You say you weren't supposed to go to university. What do you mean? Where are you from?
So I'm from Derry. I went to a 60% free school maiden school. I myself was on free school maids, and I grew up with a family of carers on benefits. So for me, I go into my law classes, and it's very rare to see somebody from my background. So they have particularly had a programme from Queen's. I get a £1,000 bursary, and to be honest, that makes up for the shortfall in the Department for Economy. They don't invest in students with grants. So I don't think the university could have been an option for me if I hadn't have had more Queen's-focused results rather than the Department for Economy.
Stay there, Ellie Jo. Financial journalist Paul Gosling with us this morning. Paul, good morning.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And Ellie Jo saying here, look, university would have been out of her reach had we been charging the same as England. England 10k, here in Northern Ireland just under 5k.
And I would much prefer the...
Okay, so we can't hear Paul at the minute. We'll get that sorted. David's in Hillsborough. Morning, David.
Morning, Stephen. There's a couple of wee points here. I haven't been speaking to you since your mother took ill, and I know that's been a big issue for you.
She's getting better. She's getting stronger. Sorry. She's getting stronger, yes. Thank goodness.
Well, that's great. She's back fighting with me,
which means she's in good form.
Stephen, when your mother's shouting at you, it's a good sign.
Exactly.
And the other thing was, I think the last day you said your degree was in history and French. Was that right?
My degree was in business, information management and French. And for goodness sake, you're back 30 years ago. What's it matter what my degree's in?
No, but the point was, you've gone on to greater things since. So you have. You've gone on to greater things since. A couple of wee points on that. There's a bursary for... student nurses.
So what do you think, David? You were going to tell me about your daughter. Do you think fees should go up or not here in Northern Ireland?
No, I don't. But I think for someone studying medicine, there should also be a bursary because we're very short in doctors at the minute. And the other side of that is when a doctor graduates and goes into F1, F2, they're expected to work 70 hours a week or thereabouts for £10 an hour for 2 years of their life.
And that's for training, is it? And learning on the job.
The first two years. After 5 years of study, then they're expected to do their F1, F2, which is generally up to 70 hours a week for £700 a week, which doesn't take... It's not hard mathematics to work out £10 an hour. The other thing which really frustrated me was Christmas last year, whenever they both my daughters got letters to say they were paying 6.25% interest on their student loan.
That's steep, right. Isn't it? That's steep, given where interest rates are.
How can our government justify that and the education system whenever millions of pounds, just let me finish this point, millions of pounds was given freely at no interest during the COVID. Do you understand my point?
Yeah, I do. I was saying that interest rate's steep. It's steep relative to where the base rate's at. However, you start paying the loan at age 25.
Yes.
At 25 grand, sorry. Once you're earning 25 grand, under 25 grand, you don't start paying the loan back. There's a wee bit of a cushion there. Paul Gosling, I know you're on a train. We'll try you again. Ellie Jo
yeah,
here.
I can hear you.
Ellie
yeah.
Jo here, who is a student, is essentially saying, look, you put the tuition fees up in Northern Ireland anywhere close to where they are in England, and that would block people like her out of an education at
I
university.
Yeah, Stephen, I think the issue is perception rather than the reality. I can understand completely why Ellie Jo and other people from low-income household backgrounds feel that they can't afford to take on the debt. But as you say, it's only a debt that's repayable once they earn a reasonable amount of money. And they are likely to earn more as a result of having gone to university. I think the question from the Northern Ireland point of view is that we just have too few students going to university. And how can we afford to support a larger student intake at the two universities? And without the tuition fees going up, it's difficult to see how that can happen. And particularly, that's so important for Derry, where we really need to have a much larger university base for the sake of the economy and to attract investment by having more skills in the local economy.
But you're saying, look, you know, when people are earning a reasonable salary, if you've got to start to pay back that student loan, if you've built up that student loan, not on drinking your way through your education, but in paying tuition fees, is 25 grand a lot of money? If the time you pay your rent, you pay your way, you pay a car, you do whatever you're doing, buses, whatever, the cost of food these days, and then you've laden yourself with debt to get your education. And they've actually reduced the threshold, Paul, from 27 yeah. and a half grand where you start to pay it to 25 grand.
Yeah. Yeah, you're completely right, Stephen. I have enormous sympathy, and I've got two kids that are still at university, so I fully understand that. And one of them is paying the lower tuition fees in Northern Ireland, one is paying the higher ones in England. I fully understand that. I would much prefer that higher education was not charging tuition fees. But in terms of the economy in Northern Ireland, we have a crisis that we don't have the skills that we need. And it's difficult to see how we build that skill base with the structure of the Northern Ireland finance at a government level. And I just don't see another way of doing it. And yes, I find it awful for students that they are going to have to be paying this back. I just don't see an alternative at this moment in time to how we finance higher levels of students in Northern Ireland.
So one of the consequences, Ellie Jo, of us keeping your fees down and other fees down for students your age at the moment is that more students... other students don't have places to go to university in the first place. We can't afford to fund them.
No, I understand that as a problem, but particularly I think that Northern Ireland is its own system within itself. I want to kind of specify in some of the points there that Paul made. I know that, you know, increasing our numbers would increase, like, increasing our tuition fees would increase the overall number of university students. But what I want to say is actually there's much less wage prospects if you stay in Northern Ireland, so it doesn't make sense to go to an English tuition fee, because if you go to England, your opportunity at a higher wage is much, much better. And I think, you know, the point was made there that, you know, it's just a scary debt, you don't actually end up paying it. But if that's the real case, what's the point in creating a fictional debt that people end up having wiped off? Is that actually money generating, or are we just making people scared to go to university? So I think, you know, for me, you know, say I come out with my law degree now, I could go and do a paralegal job, 19k a year. I'm not going to make that 25k a year minimum for quite a number of years, probably. So I actually think if I'm in England, I have a much higher chance at a wage, so I may as well just go over there for university. So I think if we're talking now about how we can afford the number of students that want to come here, you actually may decrease it through this measure, because if
you're
I'm going to
you're loading that slightly though, Ellie Jo, aren't you? You're talking about the 19k you'll be making as a paralegal when you get out. You're not talking about the big bucks you'll be making when you make it big.
Yeah, but even within that, trying to say if you want to become a barrister, you have to pay 10k out of your own pocket. So you already were priced out of that. So I think generally not everybody wants to go on and be a solicitor, but those initial wages where you're coming out, the prospects in general in Northern Ireland are much, much lower. You know, a high rate for us that are here could be 50k, in England it could be 100k.
So how old are you?
I'm 20.
Presumably you're staying in Northern Ireland not just for the money. Or was the money the key incentive?
It would be more reason to leave the money if I really wanted, in terms of wage. But no, for me, I'm staying because I actually want to contribute to my community. I'm still in law with politics. You know, I've grown up in a low-income background. I suppose for me, I want to go into law to be able to protect people in my community and kind of work for them. So,
and do you want to be a lawyer, or do you want to be a politician?
I want to be a solicitor. So yeah, no, I definitely, politics is a consideration, but it's terrifying. So I don't think.
What's terrifying about it?
I think in general, I don't really enjoy the party politics end of things. And I think, you know, being able to work for people day in, day out and not kind of worry about that and the party politics of it and the electoral politics is more my idea.
I don't want to be condescending, but you're so articulate. Like you really are. You're impressive. I've never heard of you before. I've never spoken to you before. But my goodness, you're impressive. You sure?
Thank you so much.
You sure you wouldn't want to go into politics, be a new generation among a new generation of politicians?
Maybe journalism. I love giving my opinions. So maybe that's
well, here, why don't, here's an offer, right? Why don't we get you on here in the Nolan Show a lot more often than you could be a commentator, a pundit with us sometimes, because we're always looking for new voices and you sound class.
I would love that. Thank you very much.
Right. So is that a deal done?
That's a deal done.
You're hired, Ellie. Thank you for coming on this morning.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. Morning to you. Robert's in Belfast. Oh, get Ellie back. She was on Top Table, was she? I see. The program that I created. I see, Ellie Jo, and I've forgotten now. I've forgotten about you. See?
What all do you do?
The BBC Nolan Show stealing another one of my discoveries. I have to have a word with this in-house team. Thank you, Ellie Jo. Sorry, I forgot you were on Top Table. That's embarrassing.
Years ago.
Thank you very much. How long ago is that?
I was 16, I'm 20 now.
I see, 4 years ago. I can't remember my own name, but we look forward to being on this radio programme. And thanks a lot. Morning to you. Robert the taxi driver, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Stephen. All taxi drivers head for Mahee Island tonight. My supper's all round. What's Big Donald become the next president?
Oh, you want to see Trump win, do you?
Donald Duck.
This man's crazy.
I'd love to see him winning, yes. He'd stop a war in Ukraine with Russia.
See, the problem with Robert the taxi driver is if he gets up before midday, he's slightly deranged. He needs his sleep.
Stephen, all joking aside.
You want Trump to win, all joking aside?
Yes. No, I really don't care who wins, to be honest with you. I'd still get behind the wheel of a taxi.
Yeah. You going to watch it tonight?
No, you must be joking. I'd be having a good trip.
Thank you, Robert. Brian and Enniskillen. Morning, Brian.
Morning, Stephen. Well, I wish you well watching the election tonight.
I bought my wee pyjamas last night for it.
How wee are your wee pyjamas?
Never you mind.
Yeah, maybe you'll be sitting in the nude watching it as well as your garden.
Anyway, what point do you want to make?
Well, I've been waiting for half an hour for your good researcher. So the point I want to make is this. I think, Ellie, I must say, I'll applaud Ellie. And your judgment's usually pretty rough, but in this case, you've got her right. I see youthful people like Ellie coming through my business month in, month out. I encourage them greatly to go to university if I see a spark in their eye towards it at all. But I do think that we need to increase the fees by a couple of thousand here. But all what right. I would say, the weak spot in Northern Ireland that I have seen is this, Stephen. Our universities should get together and build good quality accommodation.
Well, there's lots of quality accommodation if you look at what's being built. Bran, thank you. Here's the 10 o'clock news. Good morning. A very important story coming up now. A warning that you may find some of the descriptions within this distressing. A man whose son has serious learning and medical conditions says the Southern Trust treated his son so badly while they were caring for him during respite that he says his son couldn't walk properly for 5 days. He's asked the Nolan Show for help to get answers. The Southern Trust is refusing to comment. Dean's story will be heard loud and clear this morning. Dean is nonverbal and also has a condition that can result in him suffering up to 10 seizures a day. His father, Declan, cares for him 24 hours a day. And sometimes Dad needs a break, and that's why respite care is so vital. But his father is terrified of allowing his son to go into respite again within the Southern Trust. As he says, within just 4 days of them caring for his son, they left him in such a state that he couldn't walk properly when he came back home. I've been speaking to Declan and began by asking him what happened to his son, Dean.
Basically, Dean goes into respite care now and again, not as often as I would like, but he was in May the 27th, came home to me on the 31st, stinking of urine, feces, couldn't walk, got him into the house, had to wheel him in. Dean's mobile, if he, depending on his seizure activity, but had to get his wheelchair, wheeled him in, brought him down to the room to change him, and the sight and the smell, Stephen, would have knocked you out. I took photographs of him, his groin area, his stomach, and he was bleeding very badly from his back side.
Dean is 32. He's profoundly disabled, therefore he needs a lot of help. He needs a lot of care. And you're telling me when he went into respite, he came back out covered in human excrement, his own?
He wasn't covered in it. Now, that would be an exaggeration, but there was feces around his bum area where they shouldn't have been, and he was bleeding, and his bum, even when I cleaned the blood away, was raw. It was totally, you know, like evident to anybody that he hadn't been washed and creamed in the 3 or 4 days that he was in their care.
My goodness, that must be terribly upsetting for you.
Well, look, Dean suffers enough. I mean, he doesn't need to suffer when it's unnecessary for basic care. I mean, it's not rocket science. You don't need letters after your name or exams to know that, you know, Dean obviously is totally dependent on someone else looking after him. So when he goes to the toilet, Dean can't physically clean himself, so he's dependent on someone else to do it. But obviously it wasn't done for whatever reason. I rang the respite facility straight away. The girl who took the phone, she wasn't in charge of things, so she just took my concerns, and the manager wasn't there. She was off. She was to tell the manager was off on the Monday for training. She rang me on Tuesday, and I said to the manager, look, you don't know what I'm talking about. Give me a WhatsApp number, and I'll send you the photographs. So I sent the photographs, and she rang me back in 20 minutes, and she was appalled. She was shocked. Her words were, she was shocked.
And this, the role of this person saying this to you was who? Was what, sorry?
She was the manager of the facility.
Okay.
And I sent her the photographs, and then I said, whenever you see the photographs, ring me back again. So she rang me back again in about 10 minutes, and she said she was, her words, not mine, she was shocked and concerned by the photographs. Now, I then rang the safeguarding team and got them involved. And to cut a long story short, my problem is obviously Dean's well-being and his care when he's not in looking after him, and he's non-verbal. When I lodged the complaint, there was a big investigation done. I could talk about this for 2 hours, but to cut a long story short, there was a big investigation done by the safeguarding team. And my concern is whenever the investigation is done, she apologised for it happening. She admitted that it happened. She'd seen the photographs and was shocked by them. But following the completion of the investigation, based upon the allegation, it is non-sustained.
Non-substantiated.
Non-substantiated. Now, there's three outcomes when you get the safeguarding team involved. Outcome number one is what I got, non-substantiated. Outcome number two could have been concerns are substantiated, but person not judged to be at continued risk of harm going forward. And three, concerns are substantiated, person judged to be at continuing risk. I wanted the second outcome, that they believed my concerns, that they acknowledged them, which they did, but I can't understand moving forward. I was told it didn't reach their threshold.
What does that mean?
Well, I looked into their threshold, and their threshold is, and I quote, measures the incident against the harm. Consideration is given to the degree and the severity, the duration and the frequency of harm, and the impact on the individual. Now, that's their policy. That's their protocol. I have it in writing. That is their... So the degree, the severity, the duration and the frequency, my son didn't tick any of them boxes. It took me 5 days. Dean couldn't walk properly for 5 days after it.
My goodness.
And moving forward, I'm concerned. And it isn't just me, Stephen. You look at the broader picture. How many people use respite facilities, residential homes, daycare centres, even hospitals for that matter, domiciliary care that come to people's houses? Who makes these thresholds? What are these thresholds? I mean, if Dean goes in again next week and he comes home with 2 stitches, no, sorry, 5 to 6 stitches now, and that would meet the threshold. There's a sprained ankle, a bruise, a cut, no, sorry, an open fracture before it would meet the threshold. Who's sitting behind a desk or who's making these policies, these guidelines for people to move forward? My wife has a terminal illness and I have a care package for her. And I befriended one of the girls, and she's been in the Dalham Assembly Care for 30 years, and I showed her the photographs. Now, I'm not looking.
And this is photographs of your son's body, is that right?
Yes, of the
sores.
Of the sores and the bleeding. She cried when she seen the photographs, and she said to me, Declan, if my manager received them, I would be sacked. Now, I'm not looking for anybody to be sacked. I'm just putting into context what a girl of 30 years in the Dalham Assembly Care, when she's seen the photograph, said to me. And my complaint is non-substantiated. How do I move forward? I look after 2 people 24 hours a day. And I don't get daycare. The only help I get is, not as often, but I get respite. How do I move forward? If something happens next month, 6 months' time, 18 months' time, but is there any point in me complaining if it doesn't reach somebody's threshold? What is their threshold? I mean, you know, as I say, you look up, which I have done, in the Oxford Dictionary, non-substantiated, the meaning for that is not supported or proven by evidence. Well, I have photographs. Or if you say substantiated, it means to show something to be true or to support a claim with facts, which I did, but it hasn't reached their threshold.
And now are you worried about your son getting into respite in the future? Would
extremely,
you trust him?
I'm going to stop it extremely, because moving forward, how can I move? And I'm actually thinking also, Stephen, if I died and Dean has to go into residential care, I'm trying to lay the foundation that I know, even when I'm not in this world, that my son's going to be looked after. My son's going to be his basic. I don't want preferential treatment. His basic care is going to be looked after. And I cannot move forward until, number one, I would like my concerns to be substantiated.
Did they meet up with you?
Yes, I've had three meetings. I'm reading off these papers, these findings.
And why have they told you it's not substantiated? If you're showing them the photographs and you're showing them the results...
Because it didn't reach the Southern Trust, whoever, their threshold. Dean's severity...
But how have they explained that to you? How have they justified that?
They said it didn't reach the
threshold.
Why
not?
I asked,
well, if someone's bleeding after being in their care, if someone can't walk for 5 days after being in their care, why doesn't it meet the threshold?
That's a very good question. That's what I want to find out.
Well, what have they said?
They have said, given that, and I quote, the consideration is given to the degree and severity of the duration and the frequency of the harm and the impact on the individual, and that did not reach Dean's skin and Dean's bleeding and Dean's not being able to walk and Dean's smelling of urine and feces didn't reach somebody's threshold. Now, that's why I come so... I've done this. I'm in this game 33 years. It isn't the first time I've challenged them. And I cannot move forward. My manager, and I quote, fully acknowledges the standard of care during respite period was not to the expected standard, given the condition of Dean's skin on his return from home. But it still doesn't meet somebody's threshold for my complaint to be substantiated. I just don't get it. I mean, it's a minefield. If you look up, which I have done, the Adult Safeguarding Prevention Protection, which was drew up on the 9th of July 2015 by Simon Hamilton, who was the Minister of Health, and signed off by David Ford. It's promote zero tolerance harm to adults resulting in abuse and neglect. There is no absolute criteria for judging when harm has become serious harm. So why does this not complaint be substantiated? My grounds for an appeal is I have to lodge an official complaint. There's no process for you to appeal. I have to lodge an official complaint.
We have gone to the Southern Trust because you came to us and you're asking us to try to get you answers.
Yes.
That's what you're doing. The Southern Trust have given us a response where they haven't answered any of the questions. They've closed down. They say they do not comment on any individual. Well, whatever happened...
I told you that was their answer before you even went to them.
But whatever happened to an individual being... the care for an individual being accountable? Why wouldn't they answer a simple question? For example, we said, who decides what the trust threshold of neglect is concerning these cases? So why would they not tell us that, for example? How does that infringe in any degree of privacy, explaining to us who decides what the safeguarding thresholds are? Why would the trust think that they're better than everybody else in terms of they don't need to be accountable to the public as to who decides the threshold of neglect? The chief executive of the Southern Trust is Maria O'Kane. The chair of the board of the Southern Trust is Eileen Mullen. I wonder, are they happy with the level of accountability that you're trying to hold them accountable? You're trying to get answers. You can't get them. I wonder, does Maria O'Kane and Eileen Mullen stand over how you've been treated and, more importantly, how your son's been treated?
So frustrating, Stephen. I'm a 61-year-old man, as I say, who's caring for two people. There's a typical example. Our Dean sleeps with me because he takes seizures in his sleep. Our Dean had a seizure this morning at 2:45. He had another seizure at 5:30. That's my sleep pattern most nights. Then I had to go up and care for my wife, who's an oxygen 24 hours a day. Now, there's worse than me out there. Don't get wrong, I'm not playing the violin and God love me. I can only fight for my home. But I want to continue my current role for the foreseeable future. I'm not infallible. I thought I was, but I'm not. But I need help. And this is the help I'm given. How do I move forward?
Do you know what they're doing? So you are alleging that your son couldn't walk for 5 days after being in the care of the Southern Trust. Yeah. You're alleging your son, as a result of Southern Trust care, was bleeding. And do you know how the Southern Trust have responded to the BBC? They've responded by telling you to ring a telephone number. So they're not reaching out to you. They're not phoning you. Maria O'Kane's staff are not saying, well, look, we'll contact him and arrange a further meeting. Here's what they've said. While we do not comment on any individual, we encourage this family to contact us.
What's that done?
So that we can discuss their ongoing concerns and advise them accordingly. Now, what I would say to the Southern Trust this morning, do you not think you should be contacting this gentleman? What on earth do you mean for him to pick up the phone and contact you? Why would you do that to this man?
It's so frustrating. I mean, I've often heard you talk about your wee mummy, Audrey, and all this, and if she, God forbid, somebody had to come in and look after her, you know, even then the care wasn't right, you know, and she could tell you physically and you could do something about it. But you see, when you're in the spice and meat sector and you've somebody non-verbal, we need trust, we need openness and transparency, but our care seems to be driven by legislation, policies, reaching thresholds. My son's care doesn't meet somebody's threshold. What happens? what, you know, where do I go? What do I, and I need that, you know, I need, if I don't have help, my current role finishes. Because, as I say, I'm only one man, and sooner or later, God forbid when that day comes, that's going to end. Because I can't physically do it. Love won't be enough to care for two people.
There will be other people within the respite network within the Southern Trust who leave their relatives, who leave their loved ones in with that respite team. So what we need to make sure here is that there's no scaremongering. We need to make sure that people who can feel safe do feel safe. Will take the Southern Trust to team up with us a lot more than no comment.
I mean, don't get me wrong. We there's procedures been put in place because they say they would still like Dean to go there, and you know the cover plan, those cold call-ins if Dean was to go in there, that someone would come without them knowing moving forward. So there has been progress, but my problem is that my complaint was non-substantiated, and this threshold. What is this threshold? Who decides what this threshold is?
They won't tell you.
Is there a graph? Well,
they certainly won't tell us.
Is there a graph somewhere where someone lodges a complaint? Now, hold on a minute. Now, 2 stitches, no, 3 stitches, no, no, 4 stitches. Yes, that's on the threshold. A fracture. Yes, that's about. You know, what is a threshold? We're talking about people's livelihoods, people's health and safety, the basics, what they're entitled to. And somebody sitting behind a desk with shirt and tie has decided such and such reaches a threshold, but such and such falls below it. If my son coming home with a bleeding backside, raw skin in his groin and under his stomach, feces and urine that would knock you out, and he can't walk then for 5 days probably until I cream him, wash him, cream him, wash him, cream him, wash him, so that skin heals itself, that doesn't reach somebody's threshold of neglect. I also went into the Oxford Dictionary to find the meaning of neglect. Fails to care for properly. Now, you know, I'm not an educated man. I'm no exams. But the Oxford Dictionary definition of neglect is fail to care for properly. What I just quoted to you, how my son came home to me, that doesn't reach somebody's threshold.
Well, look, I think we've got a job to work to do here. And if the Southern Trust want to try to not answer any questions, I guess that's their prerogative. But we know what to do in response to that. So what we will do as a programme on your behalf, first of all, we will contact political representatives from the area and we'll see if they can get any answers. Secondly, we will put in a Freedom of Information request. Let's just see how many complaints there's been or not been about the respite care within the Southern Trust. If they don't want to openly engage, then we'll try to force as much information out of this trust as we possibly can. What you can also do, if you want to, is you can put in a subject, what's called a subject access request. And that is, you're entitled to all of the medical details, the medical forms, the medical assessments about your son. So you are entitled to know every bit of information they have about your son's care. So we could team up here to try to get answers. We can go at it from the FOI route. You can go at it from the SAR route.
We'll
help you understand that subject access request, and then you can decide whether you want to. It's not for me to tell you to do it, but you can decide whether you want to do it or not. We'll put in the FOI. We'll contact political representatives. And I would just say to the Southern Trust this morning, this is about a community partnership and us understanding, given the concerns that you've made about your son, whether this was a one-off or not.
And when you say that, my Dean was in this facility for 2 years and I was quite happy with his care. So I raised at the meeting, what happened them 4 nights? Because I didn't have this complaint for 2 years. I was happy Dean didn't ever come home to me in that state before. I said, did you get new staffing? Have you changed how you do things? What happened? No, same staff. And they told me cream was applied while Dean was there. I have photographic evidence. Dean gets 2 types of cream. And would you look into the cream? There is bees wax in it, the cream, it's pseudocreme. There's beeswax in it, there's paraffin in it, there's alcohol in it. That doesn't evaporate. I collect Dean at 11 o'clock. That's when you take Dean home. They send you out the next day somebody to say, just, oh, Dean, have a good, great day. And what are you doing? Are you doing your jigsaws, watching DVDs? But what they told me, which I couldn't have quoted to you before, but they tell you Dean had a bowel motion on the 31st of the 5th. That was at 10:31. They're very precise about that. I collect Dean at 11 o'clock, 29 minutes after Dean had a bowel motion. When you clean Dean's bum, would have seen blood on the toilet roll. It was impossible not to. I took Dean home. I was home up at 12 o'clock, and that's when I looked at Dean's backside. There was no traces of pseudocreme. It wouldn't have evaporated in 60 minutes. It would have been still there. Traces of it would have been there. There is no cream whatsoever in my photographs. And also, they let it be known to me, which I didn't know. They could have told me Dean had a bowel motion 2 days before I collected them. But they didn't realise where this was leading, that I have it on record. Dean went to the toilet at 10:31.
You clearly have enough on your plate. And you're fighting for your son, and you need respite, and you need to be able to trust the Southern Trust. You need to be able to be reassured. So we will fight behind the scenes here to get you answers beyond. We don't comment on an individual, and we will see what we can do for you. Okay?
Thank you, and I appreciate it. I'm sure you get thousands of emails. Thanks for picking up on mine. I really appreciate it, because
I'm at
my wit's end.
I can hear that.
Just to finish off this conversation, Stephen, because I know you're a bit busy, I watched a show the other night on television, just hypothetically, it's a bit of a hospital, it's just a different, it's called The Resident. One of the episodes, this old lady came in pushing her husband in a wheelchair, and he had took a stroke or something, so he was took away to be seen, and she burst out crying, and the medical staff, what's wrong? I can't do this anymore. I can't do this. And this is what's wrong? Every time we go to bed at night and I wake up in the morning, I look over at my husband and I hope he has died in his sleep, because I can't do this anymore. I never want to look at my two loved ones with that thought. I want to continue on with my role, but I need help. I never want to look at them and wish that they're not here to make my life easier.
Well, you've got as much as we can do for you. We will help you as much as we can. I am saying to the chief executive of the Southern Trust this morning, Marie O'Kane, how on earth is your trust not reaching out to this man? Listen to how distraught he is. And you're giving us a phone number for him to ring you? Leave this with us. All right? Leave it with us.
Thanks. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, the full statement from the Southern Trust, they say that they take safeguarding concerns seriously. They respond in line with the regional adult safeguarding operational procedures. While we do not comment on any individual, we encourage this family to contact us directly so that we can discuss their ongoing concerns and advise them accordingly. Please call Southern Trust Service User Feedback Team, and then they give a telephone number. No offer to reach out to this man. They've met him 3 times and it seems to be that's it. We have already submitted the Freedom of Information request and we will keep you across this story. Maliki in Belfast. Morning, Maliki.
Hey, Stephen.
Good morning.
Just on your earlier conversation, the American elections, boy, I'm obsessed about it.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus. I'm with you, mate. I will be up all night watching it.
I'm excited. I am genuinely excited.
Well, you'd be good on that, because I'll tell you why. I watch CNN. And CNN...
I watch CNN too. CNN's brilliant.
Absolutely fantastic. And their anchor people...
As is, and I mean this, as is the BBC coverage. It's brilliant.
You've got Erin Burnett and Anderson Cooper and Caitlin Collins for CNN. You've got Donald O'Sullivan... I'm sure you know this wee Irish guy who works for CNN.
Yeah.
On the BBC, you've got Katrina Perry. She's an ex-RTE reporter.
Yeah. The BBC coverage is top-notch as well. It's just an exciting night to be to be, if you want to flick between the channels, you know, stay with the BBC, I guess, is a good corporate thing for me to say. But there's brilliant coverage. And look, Buckler's out there for us as well. You're getting that local angle from Buckler. So look, enjoy it. And we'll be all talking about the result. We'll be talking about this tomorrow, that's for sure. Thank you, Malachy. Thanks, everyone. If you want to tweet me tonight, if you're watching the election, I'll be up. I'll be awake throughout the night at Stephen Nolan. And I'll see you back here at 9 o'clock in the morning. Thank you for listening. Have a good day.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.